Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The captain, you know, he went on the radio and he's like, we just want to make sure everyone knows he has a Paralympic champion on the plane.
On the Podium is back with more Olympians and Paralympians sharing their remarkable stories. On the Podium. Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday, August the 7th, these are our main stories.
We don't have weapons, but we do have our hearts. We have our blood. And we've decided to put our blood at the service of our country's defence. This is why we are deployed not only at the main crossroads in Niamey, but also at many points and crossroads in the interior.
Mali and Burkina Faso agree to provide what they call a joint delegation to aid the generals behind Niger's coup as they warn hostile neighbours against sending troops in. A worsening security situation in Ethiopia with fighting in Amhara and a reported mass roundup in Addis Ababa. And Donald Trump's legal team must respond to the US Justice Department by 5 p.m. local time. Also in this podcast, we find out the link between our feathered friends and good human mental health. The position of Niger's generals defying an ultimatum to reinstate the elected president, closing its airspace and preparing for defence, will only have been bolstered by two other countries run by military governments, Mali and Burkina Faso. They've said they'll send a joint delegation in solidarity in the face of possible armed intervention from other West African states. The French national airline has now suspended flights to the capitals of Mali and Burkina Faso. Meanwhile, the regional bloc ECOWAS is divided over whether to act militarily. A Niger spokesman, Amadou Abdramane, said his country would resist any interference.
Niger's armed forces and all our defence and security forces, backed by the unfailing support of our people, are ready to defend the integrity of our territory and the honour of our homeland.
This demonstrator said people stood resolutely behind the coup leaders.
We don't have weapons, but we do have our hearts. We have our blood, and we've decided to put our blood at the service of our country's defence. This is why we are deployed not only at the main crossroads in Niamey, but also at many points and crossroads in the interior.
The army said it believes preparations to invade Niger have begun, but gave no evidence. Earlier, I spoke to Chris Iwoka, who's on the border between Nigeria and Niger.
Right now, at the border here, there is some form of tension amongst the people of the border communities, essentially because if there's going to be any particular, let's say, deployment, for instance, if ECOWAS chooses to deploy, they would be the one that will be well affected. Are they already affected as a result of the border closure because all their businesses appear to have been grounded? But right now, what we've seen is a form of defiance from the coup leaders in Niamey. And we've also seen the kind of support seemingly from the people, especially in the capital, and which appear to be bolstering the energy of the coup leaders, who has also gotten the support of some West African neighbors.
So why are Mali and Burkina Faso being so supportive?
Well, right now, what we know is that Mali and Burkina Faso, they are French-speaking countries. They've been under the same colonial power. That's under France, which had been the colonial power at a time. And currently, they are also ruled by the military. So it is more like showing solidarity to another comrade who has now joined a league. So with Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger sharing common boundaries, making a threesome, it could also help in bolstering the holds of Burkina Faso military junta and that of Mali in power, while they will help the Niger group to consolidate. However, this is what the ECOWAS leadership is really angry about and wants to stop because they fear that any consolidation of power by the military within the sub-region could also encourage further coup, which would destabilize the region. And don't forget, too, that within these two countries, they have in common these groups linked to Islamic State group as well as Al-Qaeda that are actually creating havoc in the Sahel.
Chris Iwoka. And staying in Africa, tension in Ethiopia's Amhara region between the army and local militias has been on the rise for months, and now fighting between them has worsened. Over the weekend, thousands of people were reportedly arrested in the capital, Addis Ababa. Kalkadan Yibultal is there and gave me more details about those detentions.
According to activists, particularly aligned with the militia group that are fighting, these people were ethnically profiled. That's what they accused the government of. And they were members of the Amhara ethnic group that live and reside in Addis Ababa. They were arrested and some of them were detained in schools and then they were transported to different detention centers. The government has not provided any figures about that. But in a statement to journalists over the weekend, the communications minister here confirmed that there have indeed been arrests made. He said that these arrests were made in connection with the violence in the Amhara region.
Our Africa editor, Richard Hamilton, told me more about the background to the conflict.
In April, the federal government said it was dismantling regional militia with the intention of integrating them into the national army. But this has been seen, particularly in the Amhara ethnic region, as a move to undermine regional authority, and they're worried that it will leave them vulnerable to attacks from outsiders or rebel groups. Now, the Ethiopian Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, has tried to unify Ethiopia, which has in the past traditionally been fragmented into different ethnic regions. And national unity, you'd think, sounds like an admirable goal. But what we saw in Tigray was a terrible, brutal war that crushed the Tigrayans and committed human rights abuses. And tens of thousands of people were killed, millions displaced. There's been a ceasefire now, but there have been calls for Abiy Ahmed to return the Nobel Peace Prize that he won in 2019 for ending the conflict with Eritrea. And the Amhara forces actually helped the federal troops in Tigray, but it now looks as if Addis Ababa is turning its attention on the Amhara region and trying to weaken it. And on Friday, it declared a state of emergency in Amhara. And this gives them power to impose curfews, ban, for example, the carrying of guns and weapons, ban public gatherings, make arrests, conduct searches without warrants, and limit media outlets and broadcasts. And the US in particular expressed concern about the situation in Amhara. So basically, it's a very worrying development.
Richard Hamilton. Now to America, where Donald Trump's legal team have a deadline of 5 p.m. local time to respond to the U.S. Justice Department, which is seeking to limit what the former president says in public about his election interference case. Mr. Trump has already suggested that the judge, Tanya Chuktan, should be removed from his case because he says she will not give him a fair trial. I spoke to CBS News reporter Wendy Gillette.
If it is granted, this protective order would do a couple of things, potentially stop Trump from making any sort of threatening remarks on social media and prevent him from sharing any evidence in the case. Prosecutors referenced a Trump post he made on Friday. He wrote, "If you go after me, I'm coming after you." Just one example of Trump's comments, both online and during speeches, in which he attacks witnesses in cases against him, political opponents. And lately, the special counsel himself, Jack Smith, the other day he called him deranged. Trump's legal team wanted more time to respond to this request for a protective order. They asked for a few more days, but the federal judge said no.
Doesn't this play, though, to, well, Donald Trump's narrative in a way in that he's going to try and make out he's being gagged here, isn't he? And that may play well with his electoral base.
Yeah, exactly. He has railed against the Justice Department, saying the indictments are just an attempt to silence him and his campaign. And a lot of people believe that. The majority of Republicans certainly believe that. He says the charges have no merit, that they're baseless. He calls it another Russia hoax and says that Smith is mentally ill. And he's also still calling the election rigged and saying he was the rightful winner.
And he wants the judge in the case, Tanya Chuktan, to be removed, saying he won't get a fair trial. Does he have any grounds to get the judge removed or any justification for saying that?
No justifications at this point. Just basically saying we can't get a fair trial in Washington because it's too liberal. His lawyers have suggested possibly moving the trial to West Virginia, but there's no real legal basis for it. And the legal experts say it's doubtful that that is actually going to happen.
Wendy Gillette. He was one of the world's longest-serving leaders, but last month, the Prime Minister of Cambodia, Hun Sen, announced that after nearly four decades in power, he would step down and hand over power to his eldest son. Now the King of Cambodia has officially appointed Hun Manite to succeed his father as Prime Minister. The change at the top, if it is one, follows elections which the opposition labelled a sham. It was barred from running candidates, and the ruling party claimed all but five seats. So, is this a dynasty in the making? Jonathan Head is our Southeast Asia correspondent.
It looks like it, doesn't it? And it's not just one family's dynasty. I mean, Cambodia is a country with very weak institutions, and it's more or less run by a collection of families, with Hun Sen the most powerful figure, but a lot of other big families who've got very rich and powerful with him. Many of them are also ministers, and some of them are also handing over to their children, the defence minister and the interior minister among them, two very powerful positions. So not just one dynasty, but several dynasties in the making. I think it's a mark of how nervous the leaders are about this transition that they're handing over to their own families. It doesn't look like they trust anybody else in the business of power. And of course, it does give, I suppose, some element of continuity for Cambodians, because Hun Sen's the only leader they've known for four decades.
What do Cambodians feel about this?
Well, if they're critical of it, they'll be keeping pretty quiet, because it's very risky to be critical of Hun Sen. You know, opposition leaders have found they're either jailed, prosecuted, or driven into exile. There have been political activists killed. So whatever Cambodians feel, I suspect some of them are, you know, unhappy about the chronic corruption and inequality in the country, the kind of rapacious environmental destruction that's gone on under Hun Sen. Others, particularly older Cambodians, actually appreciate Hun Sen's strong leadership, the fact that they've had a quarter century of peace and development after some pretty dreadful years in the 20th century. So I think feelings will be mixed.
So from what you're saying, it doesn't sound like much is actually going to change.
It won't, because Hun Manet's an untested figure in politics. He's been prominent in the army. He's also completely different from his father. His father had this searing experience of fighting in the civil war in Cambodia, of being under the Khmer Rouge. He's a very, very tough, wily, street-smart man. Hun Manet's been brought up in a very wealthy, comfortable family. He's Western educated. But because he's inexperienced, his father is keeping quite important political positions and has made it clear he will continue to influence things from behind the scenes. This is a very big moment for Cambodia, but as a political transition, it's one that Hun Sen intends to manage and to take some time over to be sure that his son can be properly embedded and that he doesn't face any challenges from other people and other political factions in the country.
Jonathan Head. 3 years after crowds poured onto the streets across Belarus protesting against a rigged presidential election, some of its highest-profile political prisoners are being held in isolation, denied visits, calls or even letters to their families for months on end. They include Maria Kolesnikova, who was sentenced to 11 years jail for her role in the peaceful street rallies, which were eventually crushed by police using violence. No one has heard from her since February. And even now, security forces are still hunting out and arresting opponents of Alexander Lukashenko's long rule. Our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, reports.
We will win all together, because evil will defeat itself.
Maria Kolesnikova's prison letters to her sister were always upbeat.
Keep strong and everything will be all right.
Even as she served an 11-year sentence for protesting against the authoritarian rule of Alexander Lukashenko.
Your sister, Maria.
But in February, the letters to Tatiana, with their smiley faces, suddenly stopped. Maria's family and her lawyer have been unable to see her either in almost 6 months.
It became an incommunicado detention when you don't have any news.
Which must be pretty scary, right, for you as a family?
For sure, yeah. I could just hope that it will not break her. But of course it influences anyone's mind in the end.
Three years ago, Maria Kolesnikova was one of the leaders of a giant wave of protests against a rigged election for president. She was hugely popular, energizing the crowds. In the end, those protests were crushed with mass arrests and police violence. But the protest spirit hasn't died. Instead, Belarusians have got creative. In Warsaw, I met two women dressed up as grannies in house coats and headscarves, chatting and cackling on a sofa and blowing their noses. They were filming a skit for social media with a photo of Lukashenko propped up behind them like an icon. They were sending up his supporters, fighting a repressive regime with laughter. The granny activists fled Belarus after the protests, like tens of thousands. Anna says her home has been searched, her relatives threatened, but she can't stay silent.
I think it's a betrayal. Maybe that's too harsh of me, but if we forget all the people in prison, then we're betraying them. If we don't speak out, who will? In Belarus, everyone is silent, because it's impossible to say a thing there.
So every week, she organises a rally in Warsaw to chant for a free Belarus and freedom for the political prisoners there. All the key opposition figures are now being denied visits, calls or letters.
We're here because we want our country to be free and democratic, and we fight for it.
There's just 30 or so protesters here in the centre of Warsaw, wrapped in the red and white Belarusian opposition flag. Of course, it's nothing like the scale of the protests that we saw 3 years ago inside Belarus itself. It is hard to keep that protest spirit alive here in exile. But that's what they are trying to do, and to tell anyone who will listen that the repression inside their country hasn't stopped.
Standing in the crowd, there's a young woman, her arms painted with dramatic tattoos. Inga escaped Belarus after 3 months in prison. She was arrested 2 years after the mass protests when police found a picture of her on a friend's phone, draped in an opposition flag. She tells me the women in prison were treated like animals. But it's something else that upsets her more.
When you get arrested and the whole prison is full of political detainees, it's insane. It feels like a nightmare. All these amazing, educated people are all in prison. That's so hard. We don't even have the right to speak. We're locked up in prison. Just for our words.
I remember when Belarusian activists would shrug off the long sentences given to their protest leaders, like Maria Kolesnikova. They were sure Lukashenko wouldn't last that long. 3 years on, they're singing their protest songs in exile. And many prisoners are being punished even further now, not freed, held in total isolation.
Sarah Rainsford. Research carried out in the US has made a connection between mental health conditions and the diversity of birds in a region, Terry Egan reports.
The emphasis on the healthful effects of nature is often placed on green spaces, lush open fields, cloudless blue skies. This research highlights the importance of a diversity of birds to that equation. It seems the lower that diversity of birds is, the higher the number of hospital admissions related to mental health conditions. The research was carried out in the US state of Michigan and compared the observations of birds done by citizen scientists with hospital admissions for anxiety and mood disorders. It suggested a direct correlation and follows on from research conducted last year suggesting that watching birds or listening to birdsong was linked to mental well-being, with the effects lasting up to 8 hours. The lead author, Dr. Rachel Buxton, said this had wider implications. If species diversity can affect mental health at the severe end of the spectrum, then it's possible the decline in biodiversity across the globe may be intricately connected with our anxiety and mood in general. Investing in nature, she said, improving and conserving communities of birds should not be viewed as a luxury, but a necessity.
Terry Egan. Still to come on the podcast.
We felt that it was not a safe environment to be in. And we knew when we took that decision how difficult that was going to be for young people who've spent 2 years raising money.
Why, despite years of planning, a 40,000-strong scouts gathering is being called off in South Korea.
Do you ever feel a bit overwhelmed when you check the news on your phone first thing in the morning?
Whenever I open up my phone, there are just endless warnings of more extreme weather to come.
I'm Hannah. I'm the presenter of a new podcast called What in the World from the BBC World Service. We're going to be here trying to help you make sense of the world around you so you can feel a little bit better about what's happening in the world. You can find What in the World wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And now. The sound there as India's main opposition leader, Rahul Gandhi, was welcomed back into Parliament, having been reinstated as an MP. He'd been sentenced to 2 years jail for defaming the Prime Minister, but that's now been revoked. So, what will it mean? A question for our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan.
This is a big boost for the main opposition Congress Party, as you heard, how the MPs from the Congress Party, and not only from the Congress, also alliance partners, were cheering as Mr. Gandhi was coming to Parliament building, as they have a debate on a no-confidence vote against the government. So what they were arguing was the whole case was politically motivated. This was all to prevent Mr. Gandhi from raising uncomfortable questions against the Hindu nationalist Prime Minister Narendra Modi. And then they also cite the Supreme Court's comments, which said that the judge in the lower court did not give a proper reason why he was disqualified. Just to explain the case, that in a campaign meeting in 2019, Mr. Gandhi allegedly made some slur against the surname called Modi, which is also the surname of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. So in a defamation case, he was given a 2-year jail sentence and that automatically disqualified him in Parliament. But then the Supreme Court has suspended the sentence and that is what made Mr. Gandhi to come back. And that has given a big boost to the Congress Party now. They can say that Mr. Gandhi will now raise all valid questions in Parliament.
Yeah, it's quite a thing that the courts triumphed in the end. But actually, the main opposition leader went up against Narendra Modi and was sentenced to 2 years in prison. That's quite scary.
That is why he was talking about how, you know, they were not being allowed to raise very valid issues, people's issues, issues concerning the country in Parliament. He was questioning, you know, what kind of democratic principles we have. Because if you look at the judgment by the Supreme Court, the interim order, which clearly states how come, like, from a lower court, then another court, then high court, then it came to the Supreme Court. Does it have to come all the way to the Supreme Court, which took only a couple of hours to say that, no, this particular judgment was not valid? And that is why Mr. Gandhi himself was questioning about how India's institutions, which act as checks and balances in a democracy, were compromised.
Anbarasan Etirajan. A grieving mother and her lawyer say they've been targeted by a campaign of abuse after suing an Irish conspiracy theory newspaper which falsely claimed her son died after being given a COVID vaccine. Deaths following the vaccines are extremely rare, but conspiracy theorists worldwide have used unrelated deaths to spread misinformation. Our social media and disinformation correspondent Mariana Spring reports.
Adele Campbell's 18-year-old son, Diego, took his own life in August 2021. Over a year later, she realised a conspiracy theory newspaper called The Irish Light had included a photo of him in an article which suggested the COVID vaccine was to blame for his death. In fact, the BBC has been told Diego had not been vaccinated when he died. Adele Campbell and her solicitor, Kieran Mulholland, are bringing a civil case against the paper and its editor, Gemma O'Doherty, for harassment with defamation. A campaign of abuse followed. Mr. Mulholland said people who supported the Irish Light called for him to be executed. Ms. Campbell said her life has been made hell. Gemma O'Doherty and the Irish Light have not responded to the BBC's request for comment. However, in online posts, Ms. O'Doherty denies harassing Adele Campbell and her legal team.
Mariana Spring. After decades of trying and failing, scientists in California have been able to create the second ever successful nuclear fusion reaction. When nuclear fusion was first achieved last December, some thought it may have been a stroke of luck. But this latest experiment could take us one step closer to the dream of abundant, clean energy, Alfie Habershon reports.
Conventional nuclear power comes from fission, where atoms are split. But this new process, fusion, is where atoms are smashed together. It's the process that powers the sun and is capable of generating more power than it takes to produce it. Scientists have been on a quest to recreate nuclear fusion on Earth since learning about it in the 1930s, because it could generate almost 4 million times more energy per kilogram than burning oil or coal. Today, it feels even more important in the battle against climate change, offering the dream of limitless clean energy, with a reaction that releases no greenhouse gases or radioactive waste byproducts. Scientists at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in the US have now demonstrated nuclear fusion on a small scale for the second time. This suggests the first demonstration by the California-based National Ignition Facility last December was not a fluke. They fired giant lasers into a long gold cylinder, which created 50% more energy coming out than the lasers put in. The US Energy Department called it a major scientific breakthrough, but immense barriers stand in the way before we see nuclear fusion lighting our homes and offices. On a small scale, creating a nuclear fusion reaction is extremely expensive, and the equipment involved still requires huge amounts of energy. Never mind the cost of powering a whole fusion power plant. It's taken nearly a century to get this far, and there's still a long way to go.
Alfie Habershon. We've heard lots about the dangerous impact that scorching heat waves are having on people around the world this summer. But what about under the sea? Oceans have hit their highest temperature on record, bringing new challenges to fish and other marine life. Dr. Catherine Longo is Principal Climate Change Scientist at the Marine Stewardship Council, working on fish sustainability.
Just like any other animals on Earth, fish have their range of temperatures and ocean conditions in which they thrive. And then once the temperature goes above or below what they are used to, they start suffering. And so what happens when there is a sudden change, which is a heat wave, is that most fish will look for waters that are better suited to them. And so what we might see is that they move suddenly, and even fishermen might see that they're not fishing the same species anymore. All of these different species are moving at the same time. And so they are moving looking for food, but also their prey items might be moving as well. And so they might not be able to find it. That might mean that they're not able to create these future generations. And so in the years to come, we see less and less of them.
Climate change scientist Dr. Catherine Longo. The Philippines has accused China's Coast Guard of firing water cannon at its vessels in the disputed South China Sea. Manila has described the actions as illegal and dangerous. Philippine ships were delivering supplies to troops on the Spratly Islands, which China claims as its territory. I got more from our East Asia editor, Jason Lee.
Well, essentially, the Philippines is saying it will do all it can to protect its sovereignty in the South China Sea. Now, the Second Thomas Shoal, which lies about 200 kilometers from the Philippines, is part of the Spratly Islands you just mentioned, and is held by the Philippines, but claimed by China as well. Earlier today, we heard from the Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos saying that he summoned China's ambassadors to the Philippines and presented him with pictures and videos of the incident that took place on Saturday. And in a press conference conference that ended a few hours ago, Manila said that it will continue to file diplomatic protests to reaffirm its commitment to the Second Tomas Shoal and made clear it will never abandon the shoal.
What's the view from China?
Well, China's Coast Guard, which carried out this interception, issued a statement regarding the condemnation from the Philippine military. It said it took what it calls necessary controls against the Philippine boats that had illegally entered its waters, it claims. China now says it made temporary special arrangements for the Philippines to transport food and other necessities to the Second Tomas Shoal, where there are some of its troops stationed there, but that Manila was bringing large quantities of construction materials Beijing deems as illegal to the shoal for some time. Now, Beijing said it had repeatedly expressed concerns to the Philippines through diplomatic channels over the situation on the shoal and suggested the two sides hold talks over the situation, but that Manila failed to respond to their suggestion. And that on Saturday, Philippines once again tried to deliver this construction material, so they had no other choice than to intercept these two vessels carrying such materials. Now, Beijing defends its position, saying the Second Tomas Shoal is part of its territory, and said China will continue to take necessary measures to safeguard its territorial sovereignty, and urged Philippines, actually, to accept the proposal for bilateral talks.
Jay Sung Lee. The motto of the international youth movement, the Scouts, is be prepared. But they weren't. It's all gone horribly wrong for the organisers of the World Scout Jamboree, a two-week campout for 40,000 teenagers from around the world in South Korea. The event's now ending early because of an incoming typhoon. Before that, the site's sweltering temperatures, inadequate toilet facilities and a lack of food forcing children to go hungry led several countries to walk out. The UK was one of them. Matt Hyde is the chief executive of the UK Scouts.
We felt that it was not a safe environment to be in. And we knew when we took that decision how difficult that was going to be for young people who've spent 2 years raising money. And that's why we feel so let down, because we were put in an invidious position.
4,500 British Scouts had to be relocated into hotels in the capital, Seoul. Our correspondent Jean McKenzie is there and told me more.
I think it's fair to say that it's not gone to plan. I mean, clearly a typhoon is unfortunate, which is the reason it's been given for pulling all the teenagers out of the site. So 45,000 of them who are attending this event, you know, that's not something that can be avoided. But yeah, as you alluded to, this has been beset by problems from the very start. We were getting reports as early as day one that the conditions on the site were not good enough. Late on Friday night was when the UK team decided that they were going to pull all of their team out. They were the first ones to do so. Now, part of the problem has been that it's just so hot here. It's so hot and humid at the moment. But it's not that atypical for this time of year in South Korea. The real issue is, Stefan, the fact that there was no shade on the site and very little provision given to deal with these very hot and humid temperatures. Alongside that, you had concerns about the sanitation. So when I spoke to the chief executive of the UK Scouts earlier, he was saying to me, you know, this actually wasn't down to the heat. It was because the toilets weren't clean enough. The showers weren't clean enough. There wasn't soap. There weren't enough medical staff. All these things came together essentially to create a site which they felt wasn't safe enough, which is why they made that decision on Friday. Others have followed them in pulling out, but yeah, clearly this decision to pull everyone out of the site today is a major one.
Yeah, we spoke a couple of days ago and I was impressed by the way you told me just how enormous this site was, this sea of tents almost as far as the eye could see. How on earth are they going to remove more than 40,000 young people and rehouse them?
Yeah, I mean, even this mission to get the 4,500 British Scouts off the site over the weekend was a big one. They had to get them in buses back to Seoul. They had to find the hotel rooms for them, which in a capital city in the middle of August is not the easiest thing to do. So we think they're going to have to put on more than 1,000 coaches tomorrow to try and get all the children out. And they're going to be using public spaces, so public halls, schools, gyms, those sorts of things. There had been a big K-pop concert that was planned for later in the week, which they're going to have to look for indoor venues for. Because, of course, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's an end to the jamboree. It just means that it's an end to the camping. So they still have to find all the activities for the kids to do. And honestly, this morning, I think the UK team are feeling pretty pleased that they got out first. They did get a bit of stick that perhaps they'd overreacted or they'd been premature. But they're the ones that got to Seoul first and have managed to hoover up all those hotel rooms. But look, it's cost the UK scouts more than £1 million, they told us today, and that's going to come out of their reserves and probably impact the programmes that they're able to do for the next 3 to 5 years. So this will have ramifications for all these organisations.
Jean McKenzie in Seoul. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Chesney Fawkes-Porter, and the producers were Phoebe Hobson and Anna Murphy. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.